Maine's Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, committed to supporting Good Shepherd Food Bank by donating another 30,000 meals this month. Learn more at leeauto.com.
Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz, joined by Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler and Senior Political Correspondent Mal Leary. This time, we're going to take a look back at the year that's about to end. According to the Associated Press survey of news organizations, politics yielded the second most important story of the year, the re-election of Republican Senator Susan Collins. Steve Missler, it may have been the second biggest news story of the year, but it was number one when it came to campaign cash thrown at that race.
Yeah, number one in terms of discussion, too, which we've certainly focused a lot on it on this podcast over the year, and for good reason, frankly. Over $200 million spent when you look at the outside groups that poured money into this race. And of course, the crazy amount of money that was raised both by Sarah Gideon, the Democrat who was challenging Republican Senator Susan Collins, and Collins herself. She doubled what she and Tom Allen spent in 2008 combined. Gideon quadrupled it. So it was just an insane amount of money. And, you know, in terms of how it affected the race, I think it just made it super negative. We saw that for sure. Sarah Gideon just didn't give swing voters and those split ticket voters enough of a reason to abandon Susan Collins. And I think that's the big takeaway at the end of the day.
Entering this year, Collins was presumed to be in considerable trouble. So let's talk a little bit more about what did she do right? And why did the Democrats ultimately fail to flip this seat?
Well, what she did right was appeal to those voters that Steve was just talking about. And that is the great number of voters in Maine who are swing voters. You can look in town after town and find Joe Biden winning and Susan Collins winning and Jared Golden winning up in the second district, splitting the ticket. Mainers tend to vote for the person and whether they think that person's going to do a good job, as opposed to what you see in some states where, you know, it's very much partisan. You vote for the Republican if you're a Republican, you vote for the Democrat if you're a Democrat. And Collins was very careful to continually go at that group and say, look, I've represented you for all these years. I'll do it again.
I think there was some dynamics of the race, not just the Senate race, but perhaps the presidential race that may have benefited Collins down the home stretch. And I think one of the things that you saw back in October and even in, you know, mid to late September, as the president continued to sort of flail in his response to the pandemic, I think a lot of voters didn't trust him. And, you know, there was a narrative being built up and some polling information that was, you know, added to that narrative that Joe Biden was going to win. And if that was seeded in the minds of swing voters that Mal was talking about, then perhaps if you were on the fence about jettisoning Susan Collins, you may have given yourself pause if you saw the potential for Democrats controlling the entire federal bureaucracy. I mean, even Dan Shea, who was doing polling for Colby College, they did four polls during the course of this race. He acknowledged in an interview with you, Erwin, actually, that they missed these voters. They did not anticipate that people who voted for Biden would actually vote for Collins. And that's exactly what happened. And it happened in Democratic strongholds that Sarah Gideon really should have won, and convincingly, and she needed to in order to build up a margin to take down Collins, who was just dominant in the second congressional district.
Well, of course, the biggest story of the year around these parts was clearly the pandemic. It arrived in Maine in March. Mal, how did Governor Mills and the legislature initially respond to this?
The initial response was bipartisan and was very effective in terms of giving emergency powers to the governor, knowing that the legislature could not continue in session as this virus was spreading. It was a matter of maybe 36 hours from the point when the leadership decided, we've got to get out of here, we've got to end this session. And they hammered together an emergency budget, and they hammered together a package of laws that gave the governor the authority to handle the pandemic on top of the powers she would have anyway. But as so much this year occurred, that slipped into partisanship later on when Republicans were saying, She was keeping stores and retail establishments and restaurants closed too long. And as we're seeing now with the huge spike, maybe she didn't keep them in place long enough.
There was that brief sort of moment of comedy, not only in the Maine legislature, but also in D.C., where they passed this, you know, $2 trillion stimulus bill designed to, you know, get people through the pandemic. And it was a moment of great uncertainty. Nobody really knew what to expect. I mean, people were washing their groceries, for crying out loud. And, you know, there was all kinds of concern about what was really coming with the virus. And I think it was bipartisan concern, and which is why Congress was able to come together and actually help the people they represent. That was a very brief moment. Looking back on it, I do wonder how much of it was disrupted because President Trump saw, you know, his own reelection fortunes dimming because, you know, the pandemic was not helpful to the economy. And certainly the response to it wasn't helpful to the economy. And so he was very eager, of course, to reopen economies, which is why he was stirring these reopen protests across the country that it turned very, very heated. And, you know, people were, armed protesters were showing up to state capitals. That didn't really happen in Maine. There were certainly protests here, but you have to wonder if, you know, the president's involvement in his own reelection worries helped make this response even more partisan than it needed to be. I mean, I think Mills encountered this weird phenomenon that you're, you know, when you're successful in suppressing the virus, people start to wonder why the restrictions are necessary anymore. And I think that, you know, I think that was the political pitfall that she found herself in and still does as we look at skyrocketing cases and death.
Yeah, and especially as we went into last summer when things really quieted down around here too. As time did go on and the governor issued more and more of her executive orders, do we know what was driving her decisions about when to open and close businesses or deal with the influx of summer visitors to the state?
She stressed it was the science. She was listening to Dr. Shaw. She was listening to other medical experts. Her sister's a doctor. So she was trying to carve these limitations out based on what they were getting for science. The problem was most people didn't get the science until much later. We're seeing the results now that we maybe have let things down a little bit too soon in terms of social distancing, number of people in a store, how many people in a restaurant, all of these sorts of things that were put in place based on science to try to reduce the spread of the disease.
They were just trying to flatten the epidemiological curve, right? If you look at the case numbers we were experiencing then and what we're experiencing now, as we tape this, we're up to almost 800 new cases in one day. Mm-hmm. Back then, we were talking about 50, 40, 60. I am sure that Governor Mills and CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah would love to go back to those times. But, you know, they were making decisions then based on numbers increases that were nominal compared to what we're talking about right now.
Of course, against this background, we also had a presidential campaign. Steve, President Trump started paying a lot of attention to Maine's 2nd District, and now he's won it twice. Does that make the district a kind of a swing state in future elections?
I'm not certain of that. I really do think it's the unique kind of candidate and president that Trump is. You know, I think he had a way of cutting across party lines in some ways in some of these areas. So I'm not sure if we'll see any of those split votes, you know, between the 1st and the 2nd District going forward. You know, there wasn't any prior to him winning that 2nd District in 2016.
Right.
It had never happened before. So you have to wonder if it's just a Trump phenomenon like so many other things, or if, you know, that district has somehow changed. I am inclined to think that the district has always been somewhat the way it is. Not a lot of things have changed there over the years. I just think the candidates have changed. It'll always be a purple district for sure. You know, if you're a Democrat, you have to run as a moderate there, as Jared Golden has done. And if you're a Republican, I think you have to take a similar tack. And I think in some ways, if you look at Trump's sort of policy agenda to the extent that there really is one, he has proposals that cut both ways in terms of the partisan spectrum. You know, you got to give him credit for what he's done in that particular part of the state.
If it's Trump running again, say in 24, I think, you know, he'd have a much better chance in the second district than some other Republican, because I think a lot of that support came as a cult of personality to him as an individual, not to his philosophy, not to his party.
As we look back over the last year, did either the Democratic or Republican parties come out ahead in Maine of where they started?
For Democrats in Maine, I think it's almost status quo. They were able to retain their majorities in the legislature. It's a little bit more of a narrow majority in the House, but it's a majority nonetheless. Same in the Senate, where they actually grew their majorities. You know, their legislative campaigns fared much better than Democratic legislative campaigns in other parts of the country. They almost saw the gains that they had in 2018 reversed. At that time, we would do this podcast and talk about those gains by Democrats and state legislatures, which is something that they really needed to do, because they were getting their clocks cleaned by the Republicans for years, because the Republicans know the value of the majorities in state legislatures. Democrats in Maine are fortunate, I think, in that regard. I mean, certainly they're stung by the fact that Susan Collins is reelected, because let's face it, they poured everything they have into defeating her, and they lost convincingly. You know, there's a lot of angst about that, you know, within the party activists. A lot of them are very upset about how Sarah Gideon was basically anointed by national Democrats to become the leading candidate. You know, they're going to have to evaluate, you know, those big statewide races, the type of candidates that they run, and maybe not let people from Washington, D.C. make those decisions for them. So in terms of Republicans, they've got to feel a little bit better about how they did in the Maine House of Representatives by, you know, chipping away and adding a few seats there, even, you know, especially given the fact that they didn't even run candidates in something like 20 House seats.
And you've got that situation with the Republicans where you really have a big, big split in the party. You have a split in the Democrats as well between the progressives and the moderates, but it's much more pronounced on the Republican side, where you have the Trumpers and you have the people supporting Susan Collins. And Collins is more moderate, despite the Democratic claims that she, you know, voted lockstep with Trump. She didn't vote lockstep, but she did support him on a lot of things. You've got a situation where the Republican Party's got to figure out who they are and what their issues are and who their leaders are. As Steve points out, they've left races uncontested where they could have won. There is not a single House seat in this state where one party can't beat the other one if they run the right candidate. And we've seen that time and time again. But they've got to spend the time and the effort to recruit the candidates and the time and effort to raise the money so those candidates can get their message across. And I don't see it happening right now. I see the same splits occurring in the legislature, where you've got part of the legislature is pretty much pro-Trump, very far to the right, and the other Republicans are much more pragmatic. And those two are at war with each other, much as in the Democratic side, the progressives are somewhat at war with the moderates.
I think there's a bit of an identity crisis there, in the sense that if you think about it, Trump came in, and as we discussed earlier in this segment, he has ideas that are contra to the party orthodoxy, at least as we know it, over the last 4 or 5 decades. And he turned a lot of that orthodoxy on its head and convinced Republicans in the Congress and certainly legislative candidates to go along with it, because, you know, they saw his success doing so. But you still have this conservative ideology that a lot of Republicans still believe in. And that includes people like Susan Collins, for example. I think Mitt Romney was actually talking about this. There are people that are adherents to those old conservative values, but they're not quite sure where those values land in the era of Trump.
All right, Steve Missler and Mal Leary, and that's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. Now, we usually update this podcast every Friday. There is also a Maine's Political Pulse newsletter. This week's reviews Maine politics month by month. Now, you can find it on mainepublic.org. Here on the Pulse podcast next week, we'll take a look ahead into 2021. We hope you will join us for that. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz. Happy holidays to you.